We're at the intersection of the COVID vaccine and what employers can do to encourage workers to get their dose. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is now one of the leading states for the average number of COVID vaccines administered each day. Nearly 823,000 doses have been administered as of yesterday. That's the latest from the Department of Health Services. And workers wonder, what can my employer do to help me get the shot? And employers wonder, what can they do to make sure their workers get vaccinated? What do you want to know about vaccine mandates in the work setting? 800-642-1234. Brittany Lopez-Nollet is partner at Reinhardt Berner Van Duren. She works in the labor and employment and litigation practices. Brittany, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just go straight to it. Are employers legally allowed to require workers to get the COVID-19 vaccine?
Generally, yes. There is nothing prohibiting an employer from mandating the vaccine at the workplace. The question, though, then becomes, should they?
Should they? Yeah. What do you see?
Generally, my thought is they shouldn't. And I'll elaborate a little bit on some of the considerations. The first one is going to be the risk level of your workplace. You know, there are obviously industries that are much higher risk in healthcare, corrections. Obviously, we've seen with meat processing and other manufacturing locations that can't socially distance. So that's one question you want to look at, the risk level. Another issue you want to look at is how will a mandate impact your workforce morale? We're seeing a good amount of either vaccine hesitancy or, you know, people who just don't want to be in the initial groups of people taking the vaccine. So it is a hesitancy in the mindset that they just want to wait a little bit. So if you have a mandate and you have a large percentage of people wanting to wait or not get the vaccine, and they don't have a religious or medical exemption, then those people would need to be excluded from the workplace or somehow working remote or doing something to keep your other employees and customers safe. And so can your workplace handle that if there is a percentage of people that are suddenly unavailable?
So can your workplace make those accommodations? Is that even feasible? What I'm hearing here from you as well is that it's not just hospitals and healthcare facilities that would be in this boat of wondering, well, you know, maybe we should mandate it because of risk. What are some other areas where you might see employers take this step to make a mandate in the workplace?
There's been a lot of discussion about it with other companies whose employees are public facing or interacting a lot with customers. You know, we have grocery store workers who have kind of been on the front lines every day still, you know, providing services. And so that's a big one. Obviously, educators is another area where, you know, we have employees that are at risk every day based on what they're doing when they're in person.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Brittany Lopez-Nollet, who's an attorney who works on cases involving employment issues, and we're discussing the role that employers have in trying to get staff vaccinated against COVID and what workplace policies might look like. With your questions, do you work around people regularly? Are you eligible to receive the vaccine? What are your thoughts on a mandate in the workplace? 800-642-1234. Brittany, in December, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued guidance on employer-mandated vaccines. What did they spell out?
So their guidance confirms that a mandate is not per se illegal. Their guidance also walks through what employers need to consider if they do implement a mandate, and that is that there are accommodations available to employees under the Americans with Disabilities Act for medical-related issues that would prevent those employees from getting the vaccine. And there's also the ability to make a request for an exemption on a religious basis under Title VII. And so the EEOC was reminding employers that they need to appropriately assess those requests for accommodation. And if those accommodations are not appropriately assessed, there is some risk for employers and some potential liability.
Well, explain there that law around, quote unquote, here, medical examinations under the ADA. What does that pertain to? You know, what is that area like?
So the vaccine itself is not a medical examination, but there may be questions associated with getting the vaccine about allergies, about whether an employee is pregnant, that would provide the employer with medical information about those employees. And there are obligations that employers have to keep the information confidential and also to make sure that that information is necessary to be gathered. Mm-hmm. And one workaround is if you have a third party that is responsible for implementing the vaccine program. So with obviously some nursing homes, we've seen Walgreens be involved or other pharmacies. That way, those third parties are the ones handling those questions and receiving that medical information. So that gives the employer some distance from that information.
And so as the employer starts to craft a policy, if they choose to do so, would that policy then perhaps center around requiring vaccination to stay employed at said company or requiring vaccination as a condition to return to the physical workplace?
So it could be both, depending on, you know, what the employer's current status of workers in the workplace is. It could be either. If you currently have a large portion of your workforce working remotely or potentially furloughed and you're looking to reopen and you have made the decision to implement a mandatory program, then it could be a condition of returning to the workplace. Mm. We are starting to see a little bit more of that. Nationally, we've seen some stories about, particularly recently, a law firm that has decided for employees to return to the office, they do need to have the vaccine.
These vaccines fall under the FDA's EUA, the Emergency Use Authorization. EUA differs greatly from full vaccine approval. How does the EUA factor into a vaccine policy at an employer?
The EEOC in their guidance did not make any distinction, and we haven't seen anything yet from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration on how that implements mandatory or voluntary programs. But for employers assessing, you know, how employees are going to react to that, that is something you want to factor into it. May give rise to some hesitancy, but there are also materials that employers and, you know, employees on their own can go and review to make sure that they have factual and reliable information that they are relying on when they are reviewing information about the vaccine. So the FDA has their EUA fact sheet. The CDC has several materials. So employees can access that on their own, or employers, if they're trying to kind of start to build encouragement for the vaccine before it is widely available, they can start providing some of those materials so that their employees are fully informed.
Attorney Brittany Lopez-Nollet is explaining what employers should bear in mind as they craft workplace COVID vaccination strategy. Do you work in healthcare or are you a first responder? Has your workplace incentivized getting vaccinated or made access to the vaccine easier for you? Are you on the fence about getting the vaccine? What communication have you received from your employer on this? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brittany Lopez-Nollet on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're discussing the newest challenge employers face in the pandemic now that COVID vaccines are being distributed. Can you require your workers to get shots? Or can you encourage employees to voluntarily get vaccinated? And if so, what kinds of incentives are permissible? And how do you establish a vaccine policy? Bring your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. We have Brittany Lopez-Nollet, who is a partner in Reinhart's labor and employment and litigation practices. She's our guide with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Sarah now, joining us from Decorah, Iowa this morning. Hi, Sarah. What would you like to add?
Hi. I actually work at a school. I'm a teacher's associate at a private school, but we're part of a larger administration in the county, and they are offering us, you know, all the teachers throughout the school-wide system, including three schools, an entire day to get vaccinated. So they're closing down the school, and they're allowing the teachers to, I mean, it's not required, it's not mandated, but they are allowing them to go and get vaccinated if they so choose. The only thing is we weren't really given a lot of information ahead of time. We were told, well, school will close in next day, and then you can get your shot then. I only, you know, even though we're educators, we kind of were supposed to kind of do all our research.
You have to have that in line ahead of time, right? Sarah, thank you for bringing that. Brittany, is that, do you think, a typical incentive there, offering time off for the employee to get vaccinated, a day in this case?
Yeah, that is a really great potential incentive, especially the way that this particular school district has chosen to do it. The incentives area is a bit gray. We're still hoping we get a little bit more guidance from the EEOC, but here, this incentive is being provided across the board to everyone, regardless of whether they choose to get the vaccine. So it is an encouragement, but you're not having any risk of, you know, making sure that people who don't get the vaccine but qualify for an accommodation receive it. And because it is across the board, you don't rise to the level of raising concerns that the EEOC has flagged, where the EEO says, if you're going to give this as an incentive to get a vaccine, it should be of de minimis value. But here, where you're giving it across the board and it's not actually tied to receipt of the vaccine, you're a lot safer. And a full day seems to be a generous incentive that district is providing.
Let's bring in John now, joining us from Door County. Hi, John. What is your question?
Hi. I had a question regarding accommodations and protections under the ADA. The Pfizer vaccine specifically is an mRNA gene treatment, not really a vaccine. Is it possible that workers have protections specifically regarding a requirement for that kind of medical treatment?
John, thanks. Brittany, could you get that with the Pfizer vaccine there?
Yes, and I'm obviously not a medical professional, and so whether there is a specific issue with, you know, whether it's the Pfizer or, you know, the Moderna, you would still need to work with your physician to assess whether either vaccine is appropriate. If for some reason only the Pfizer vaccine was available to you and that was not going to be medically appropriate for you, you would work through your normal, it's called the interactive process with your employer, where you submit that you need an accommodation and then you work through that process with them. If only one of the two vaccines would be inappropriate for you, they would still, if there's a mandate, may be able to request that you get the other one, but there might be some accommodation built in around giving you some extra time to get that, given some of the restrictions you may have.
Can we spend a moment here on HIPAA, the federal privacy law? You know, a person's vaccinations are confidential information under HIPAA. How would HIPAA factor into what an employer can do on the vaccine policy?
So HIPAA normally is not going to cover most employers because they're not healthcare providers, But employers are governed by their obligations under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which does require them to keep medical information confidential. So it's still a similar requirement to maintain that confidentiality. It's just coming from a different federal statute. And so employers, a lot of this goes to your planning. If you're going to mandate a vaccine, if you're going to require employees to give you things like proof of vaccine that might have medical information, you need to make sure you're prepared ahead of time to how you're going to maintain that separate from personnel files and keep it confidential. So a lot of this goes back to planning. Whatever you're going to do, whether it's mandatory or voluntary with some encouragement, make sure you're planning on the front end for communicating with employees, making them feel like they're a part of the process, getting feedback, and that can really help this go a lot more smoothly.
We're talking with Brittany Lopez-Nollet, an attorney focusing on employment litigation. We're discussing whether COVID vaccine policy in the workplace is doable, and if so, what does it look like? With your questions, 800-642-1234. John is with us from Eau Claire with a question. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm allergic to the flu shot, or one of them, and if my employer is requiring me to keep my job, I need to get this vaccine, and I have an allergic reaction to it, can I hold my employer liable?
John, thank you. Brittany, go ahead.
Those are some questions that are going to get pretty fact-specific. Generally, claims against employers for workplace injury and illness would be covered by workers' compensation. So I can't tell you for sure yes or no. And again, obviously, if there are some potential medical risks, you should potentially go through that accommodation process with your employer and see whether there is an appropriate accommodation if the vaccine could be unsafe for you.
Brittany, circling back for a moment to incentives, would employers ever provide an incentive for gift cards or for any type of money or bonus?
There is some availability to do that, and that is where it does get a little bit gray, because the EEOC's current proposed rules attempted to clarify the scope of incentives, and they have provided that those incentives may be a de minimis incentive. But again, where is that line can be a little complicated. You know, if you're giving away gift cards in smaller denominations, maybe $20, $25, that may be relatively safe. But potentially, if you are giving away something of a larger value, I've seen recently in the news, I believe there's a meat processing company that was giving like potentially like $100, and I think a hospital system was giving $500. Those are going to be a little bit riskier from a liability standpoint until we get more guidance from the EEOC.
Let's turn to employers starting to phase in their workers back into the workplace if they've been having their workers work remotely from home. Can you talk about additional safety considerations that employers need to really have their ducks in a row on as they phase their employees back into the office?
Absolutely. Again, kind of the pre-planning and the communication is going to be really critical on this. OSHA just came out with some guidance that encourages employers to have a COVID, kind of a preparedness plan, and they list 16 different things that should potentially be in there. And it's everything from, how are we going to increase cleaning? Are we social distancing, wearing masks? What is the policy for communicating with employees if they are exposed or someone is ill? Checking your ventilation, what can you do to improve that? How are we going to handle if someone gets sick at work, including all of your guidelines for taking time off? It's helpful to have this comprehensive program and put in the work on the front end. That way, employees feel like you are putting their safety first. You're planning for them to be here and keep it safe. They can raise issues. And if there is a potential issue, you have something that you can use to show that, we have really taken steps to reduce risk here.
What happens with noncompliance when the employee refuses to wear a mask in the workplace?
So if you have an employee who is required to be wearing a mask, you know, obviously there may be some exceptions if people have an individual office or they're working where they're relatively isolated. There may be some lenience on that. But if you have a mandatory mask policy, it's going to be like any other workplace policy, and it needs to be enforced, and it needs to be enforced consistently.
Brittany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Brittany Lopez-Nalad is a partner at Reinhardt Berner Van Duren and based at its Milwaukee office. Coming up, we check in on the trucking industry to find out how freight operators are navigating supply and demand challenges and a sizable increase in freight shipping. Are you a trucker? How busy are you? What do you see going on the horizon? 800-642-1234. We'll look at over-the-road trucking after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Years ago today, former Republican Governor Scott Walker held a press conference to introduce the bill now known in Wisconsin as Act 10. The proposal sparked massive protests as unions warned the plan could redefine organized labor in the state. As Sean Johnson reports, they were right.
Just 2 days after Walker introduced Act 10, teachers were already gathering outside the Wisconsin State Capitol. It was a small group at first. Some gave speeches.
Listen up, guys. This way, please.
We could lose this fight.
Charles Patton, who was then a teacher from Wausau, warned that if the public viewed this fight as a dispute over teachers' pay, Walker would win.
We must help our neighbors. All of the citizens of Wisconsin see that union rights are every worker's rights.
Days later, the protest crowd numbered in the thousands. It included teacher Diana Calopi of Whitewater, who decided she had to come to Madison to try to stop Walker's bill.
Life will probably never go back to normal unless this gets killed.
Eventually, though, Republicans passed the bill, and Walker signed it. In the state that was the birthplace for public sector unions, Act 10 was now law. In a recent interview reflecting on the 10-year anniversary of the protests, Calopi says she's still teaching in Whitewater, where teachers continue to keep their union. But these days, not everyone pays their dues.
We clearly don't have 100% membership anymore, and a lot of it's financial. That's the number one reason people tell us they can't do it, because they can't afford to have anything else taken out of their paycheck.
Looking back, Charles Patton says Act 10 changed everything. He left Wausau and took a higher-paying teaching job in California.
It's partly financial, yes, but it's also cultural. And so there's some of that. The progressive Wisconsin of my youth, I think, is gone.
10 years after Act 10, organized labor forges on in Wisconsin. But being a union member today means something different. For most public sector unions to even exist, they have to get a majority of all members to vote every year to recertify. They can only bargain for small raises. Other benefits are off the table. Before Act 10, the percentage of all Wisconsin workers who belonged to a union was well above the national rate. University of Wisconsin-Madison labor economist Laura Dresser says a decade later, it's lower.
This policy really mattered to union density in this state.
Union membership dropped here from about 15% in 2010 to less than 9% last year. No other Midwest state saw a steeper decline. Wisconsin Democracy Campaign Director Matt Rothschild says union spending on lobbying in Wisconsin is also on the decline.
Unions in the Capitol in Madison are not throwing their weight around as much as they used to, for sure.
The last legislative session before Walker took office, the Wisconsin Education Association Council had a total of 17 lobbyists and spent almost $2.5 million trying to influence state government. Last year, the teachers' union hired 2 lobbyists and spent just over $70,000. Still, Wisconsin AFL-CIO Director Stephanie Bloomingdale says the Act 10 protests lit a spark for unions that continues today. People saw unions fight for their members. She says it was meaningful.
That strength of conviction and that willingness to continue to persevere because of what we believe in is so important. That is a moment in our collective history that will never be forgotten.
Others aren't so sure. Patrick Wyckoff is the executive director of Ask Me Council 32 in Wisconsin, a public sector union that represents everyone from prison guards to custodians. He says people have a romantic view of the Act 10 protests, but Wisconsin's workforce has changed.
The majority of our potential members and members weren't employed here for Act 10. So this is history to them. It's like 9/11 to my kids. It was a once-in-a-lifetime thing that we went through, but my kids don't remember it.
Wyckoff says these days his union concentrates on working conditions, a lot like the union his dad and grandpa were in. But it's a far cry from the kind of union Wisconsin workers knew just 10 years ago. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're talking freight activity and long-haul trucking. The Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association testified before the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee last week. Its executive delivered this message. When many Americans begin working from home, truckers continued to crisscross the country, picking up and delivering the things that we all need. The industry is concerned about new federal regulations, rising insurance premiums, and the future of the overtime exemption. Are you a truck driver? How has your work changed amid the pandemic? What questions do you have about the industry? 800-642-1234. Rob Reich is Executive Vice President and Chief Administrative Officer for Schneider National. That's a freight transportation and trucking company based in Green Bay. Rob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Well, give us your read on the industry. How has the pandemic affected trucking and freight transportation as a whole?
Well, very similar to the economy as a whole, Kate, we all saw a dramatic drop in freight volumes in the second quarter when the pandemic shutdowns first occurred. So we saw a big uptick in March as everybody stocked up on toilet paper and everything they needed for their house, and then a dramatic drop with all of the shutdowns. Since then, though, we've seen some recovery and saw very positive momentum from a freight volume standpoint in the fourth quarter. The American Trucking Association does a freight tonnage report, and they showed that December was actually the first month with more freight volume year over year since March. So we're seeing a nice recovery and some positive momentum.
Yeah, freight volume, truck tonnage clearly outperforming our broader economy. Freight continued to move despite COVID. Are economic conditions for truckers as fragile or volatile as we may think?
Well, there's always volatility, I think, given the uncertain nature of the pandemic. But, positive news, obviously, with the vaccine rolling out. So I think given consumer decisions, we're seeing a lot of strong consumption. All of us continue to buy things for the house. We've seen a lot more single family home building, and that always generates a lot of freight for everything that you have to buy to put in a new house. So you put all that together, and again, a better economic situation that we seem to be approaching, I think, again, fairly positive perspective.
What are you experiencing at Schneider National? Are you hiring or are you in, a plateau time, or what is it like?
Oh, we're absolutely hiring, Kate. We clearly see there's more freight than the industry can handle right now. And so we're hiring, and I think everyone else is as well, trying to find additional drivers to deal with the freight volume. So no plateau whatsoever. And it's hard to find drivers. As you talked about with OIDA's testimony in Washington, we all got to feel really proud of all of our Schneider drivers and all the drivers in the industry who have so successfully and safely handled the pandemic. And we need more of them. So absolutely, we're hiring.
Why is it hard to find drivers?
You know, I think you look at the blue collar side of the labor force, there are a lot of options for people right now, given where there is economic activity. So warehousing, now it's winter here, so we're seeing not as much construction, but in other parts of the country, construction still continues. So there's a lot of competition for the folks that would consider driving as a career.
Rob Reich is with us, Chief Administrative Officer for Schneider National. That's a trucking company based in Green Bay. As we take a look at the industry, let's bring in John now, joining us from Elkhorn. Hi, John. And I understand you are a truck driver.
Yeah. Good morning. Yeah, I'm actually sitting in my truck right now waiting for the warm-up procedure to finish. And I'm on Indeed, and I get calls probably 3 times a week from recruiters trying to get me to move to over the road. I do local right now, but yesterday I actually put in my notice where I work now because I'm going to go to work for a friend of mine that has a trucking company with 40 trucks, and because he is so swamped, he can't keep up. And I live alone and I have a dog, and the thing that was keeping me from doing long haul driving or multiple day was I would need to take my dog with, because I can't leave it alone at home. And he said, yeah, no problem, that you can bring it along. And because of that, then I can now do over the road. But from what I can see in southern Wisconsin anyways, there's just a huge lack of drivers. I seriously get at least 3 to 4 recruiters a week that email me or call me looking if I would come work for them.
John, let me ask you this. With the tight demand and all the incentives out there, do you see your pay going up?
Well, I mean, it is now because I'm going from a local drive where I just do local hauls, only driving 150, 250 miles a day, to where I'll be driving 2,500 to 3,000 miles a week. And so my pay is going to basically double. But looking at all the jobs that I was offered, it looks like the average is between 22 and 25 an hour for drivers. And I've been driving for years. I used to drive a dump truck and haul corn, green corn, and I used to make 17 an hour. So that was only a couple of years ago, and now we see the average is around 22 to 25.
John, thank you for bringing your story. Rob, what do you see out of John's situation there, getting calls from recruiters all the time?
That doesn't surprise me at all, Kate. In fact, I hope Schneider called John. We'd love to. So that's really the nature of the competitive issues I talked about for drivers is we're all looking, and if their resume's out on Indeed, we've got a recruiter who's going to call them for sure. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And it's interesting. I think, you know, John's decision is a frequent one that we see is the trade-off between do I want to drive local and get home every night, or do I pursue the higher paying jobs that are going to require me to be over the road during the week and just get home on the weekends?
Yeah, and about 3/4 of your drivers are in the over the road category, I understand.
That's right, Kate. We're predominantly over the road organization. Now, we have a decent number of jobs that get home every day, like the one John talked about, but most of our drivers are going to be out over the road at least part of the week and then home on the weekends.
Trucking Logistics Executive Rob Reich explaining how the trucking industry has responded to the market fluctuations amid the economic fallout from COVID. Have you considered becoming a long-haul trucker? Are you a small operator or an independent trucking contractor? What are the advantages? What are the drawbacks of your work? And what do you see out there on the horizon for your industry? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Rob Reich here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Rob Reich on the trucking industry amid COVID. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that the number of trucking companies that went out of business in 2020 nearly tripled compared to 2019. About 3,100 fleets shut down and smaller trucking firms were particularly hard hit. Are you an over-the-road trucker? What has the pandemic been like for you? Is your tonnage trending up or downward? What will the spring and summer hold? 800-642-1234. Rob Reich of Schneider National is with us for about 10 more minutes. Rob, what do you make of that data, that more than 3,100 fleets shut down last year? What is happening to small truckers in this segment of the industry?
Yeah, I think what you see there, Kate, is when you're small, there's a little bit more risk because you tend to be aligned with just a couple of customers. And with the very quick drop off in freight volumes in the second quarter, I think that's what hit a lot of those smaller guys. Is if you were aligned with one of your bigger customers who say shut down for 2 months, that was a fairly significant financial hit. Whereas if you're a larger fleet, of course, you have a wide variety of customers. So I think that's probably one of the real driving factors to seeing the smaller fleets suffer like that.
Let's bring in Steve now in Lake Geneva. Hi, Steve. Oh, Steve is not there. Steve was looking for a second career after retiring, has always enjoyed driving. And Steve was wondering, do you see people doing encore careers in trucking?
We sure do, Kate. Actually, that's fairly common. People may be surprised that the average age of a driver that we hire out of a truck driving school, so somebody who's just coming into the industry, is 38. So we tend to see folks who this is their second and third career after they've done some other things. And we absolutely see people who are retiring who are coming into the industry. We hire a lot, for example, out of the military retirees coming to join us and other folks as well. So fairly common.
Let's bring in Cindy now in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning. I'm just wondering how the autonomous vehicle is going to affect the industry and when do you see that on the horizon?
Cindy, thank you. Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
So there's definitely autonomous technology being worked in the industry. It's something we're taking a look at and involved with. I think it's going to be a while until that technology is really mature enough where we might see it on the highways. However, I think what you'll see is it's more of an on-highway, longer-haul application. On either end, you're still going to have really good driving jobs that are working with the customer, picking up the freight, and delivering it to a point where perhaps an autonomous vehicle could pick it up and do some of the highway driving. So I think it could change what some of the jobs look like and actually create better time at home and better jobs from that sense of keeping the drivers closer to home.
Jacob is with us from Eau Claire in the trucking industry for 20 years. Jacob, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead. What is your story? What would you like to add?
Well, I run Reefer Dedicated for JBS for the last couple of years, and through COVID, it took a big hit as plants shut down. I ended up getting laid off for 3 months as freight pretty much came to a real big slowdown.
What is it like now for you?
It started picking back up, I'd say October last year. It started picking back up again, and it's been going pretty strong as there's been a big demand for food.
And are you over the road or local?
I run regional. I run mainly Midwest.
Yeah. And very quickly, Jacob, why are you a truck driver? What keeps you in the industry?
What keeps me in the industry is basically the money. I mean, it's out there, and money has gone up in the industry over the last few years.
Jacob, thank you for sharing your story. You know, Rob, it sounds like Jacob has that satisfaction, even though he was laid off for a period of months early on in COVID, that the, you know, making the money is there.
Absolutely. As Jacob talked about, the money's there and it's increasing. We've just rolled out some driver pay increases to our fleet that range from 5 to 20%. And so it is a job where you can make a good living at it.
Do you feel like the competitiveness to get drivers and to keep those drivers with you, does that, you know, bring up the costs and the salaries, the wages?
Absolutely. It's classic supply and demand for sure. And within trucking companies and again, with other industries that are looking for folks with some similar skill sets. So that absolutely drives pay, and we're seeing that in the industry.
Let's look at COVID specifically. How is COVID testing being handled by the trucking industry or looking inward at your company?
Yeah, we've got a good HR team that we put together, Kate, to work with all of our associates, drivers and non-drivers alike. So if there's any symptoms or anything like that, if you're a driver who's driving over the road, we make sure we get you routed home right away so you can get tested at home. And then we've got just a really good quarantine process if necessary, and a good support network for the drivers if we've got to get them home with symptoms and or a positive test or exposure to someone else. So I think it's all about a good process, and we're seeing that with the vaccinations rolling out. The states that are doing well just have a good process of managing that, and we had to do the same thing as people had symptoms.
We're talking with Rob Reich, Chief Administrative Officer for Schneider National. It's a freight transportation and trucking company in Green Bay. We're checking in on the trucking industry amid the pandemic. Let's go to Colette now in Lac des Flambeaux. Hi, Colette.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your story?
Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Well, I've been an over-the-road truck driver for 30 years. And when I got in the business 30 years ago, I was made aware that there was a trucking shortage for drivers. I see the same thing now. I haven't seen it get any better. But trucking companies will get you in the door. They'll tell you a story, and you're out for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and that usually doesn't coincide with a good life at home. Now, being home on the weekend, as I've heard the man from Schneider talk about, people will be out 5.5 days. They come home for a day and a half. They can barely breathe, and they're back out there. Now, I've worked for a huge company where I was home 5 times in 1 year.
Wow.
Now I work for a company that I'm out 5 to 9 days. I don't get a lot of benefits, but the benefits I do get, I have quality time at home, and I have less waiting at the docks. I'm not compensated probably monetarily as much as I might be making with a huge trucking company.
And Colette, we are short on time, and thank you for sharing your story about how to negotiate that work-life balance. Rob, how do you try to do that when your truckers are only home on the weekends?
Yeah, it really is, Kate, making sure you get them home when you've committed to. It's what Colette was mentioning. It's really important that if you're going to set up a 5 days out, 2 days off, you have to live that out. And we think being able to live the expected plan is a really important part of lifestyle, as you get home when you intend to get home.
Very quickly, as we wrap up here, what are your efforts on diversity and inclusion as you broaden who is a truck driver in America?
Yeah, that's really important to us. We're very proud that we tend to reflect the communities in which we operate in our driver force, but we want to make sure that we're expanding our abilities there, particularly with women. So about 8% of our fleet today are female drivers, and we think we can do a lot more there. And so we're looking at how we spec the trucks, the nature of our operating centers, just to make sure we're extremely welcoming and have the right tools and processes available to support any driver, men or women.
Rob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Rob Reich, Executive Vice President and Chief Administrative Officer for Schneider National, based in Green Bay. Just ahead, a decade of Act 10. We talk with educators, and former Governor Scott Walker is here. What is the lasting legacy of Act 10, which limited collective bargaining rights for most public employees? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.